sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The markets are higher again around the world. Oil approaching 95 plus. Where will it go? The VIX at a four-year low. And our special guest today is Tom McClellan. And we'll talk to him about presidential cycles and a whole bunch of other things that are showing us some conflicting indications of where the markets are going. All this and much more on this exciting episode, number 276 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, and I hope you're enjoying your summer. I hope you had some great time on a vacation. We posted some more of our pictures coming up this week from Bali when I went a few weeks ago to the southern part of Asia. Remember, I went to Singapore and Bali and also Cambodia. So I put some pictures up of the things that I saw in Bali. Great place to visit, great food, great people. A lot of religious significance there, and if you've ever had the chance to go, well, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, I do suggest, even though it's a long ride from the U.S., what a magical place. Just really a sensational place to spend a few days, a week or so in Asia. But I do have a lot to talk about today. Again, it is towards the end of summer, which means that volumes on the major indices will be falling off. Because a lot of the head traders are on vacation. It's kind of a time of year when a lot of psychiatrists and traders take off. So I don't know about you, but it's always a time of year that really spooks me. I mean, you know, if all the psychiatrists are taking off and, you know, a lot of people are not going to be able to make their appointments. And who knows what happens, you know, what we're going to see, maybe a full moon and some crazy things happening with markets. But again, we do have Tom McClellan. He is a regular guest. And he always brings us some great insight into some important indicators that he studies. He really gets down to the nitty-gritty when it comes to all the market statistics and trends and cycles. And I have to ask him, I really want to know about some of the presidential cycles and some of the results we see in the past and how the algorithm and the setup is shaping up for this year. So we're going to talk about that. Markets are higher again. We saw that the after effects are continuing from the conversation earlier in the month by the ECB when they said basically they're going to do everything, which of course, as I always say, means lying, cheating, manipulating the truth, moving the currency around, and changing written policy just on a whim. You really can't trust a lot of things they've been saying, and I'm not going to get into a whole long and boring rant and discussion about this, but the fact of the matter is that they have a lot of conflict there. Germany supposedly is on board, but if you read the words very carefully, they choose those words very, very carefully as well because they want to make sure that they have outs. It's kind of like, you remember when President Obama came out and he said, we're going to create or save, you know, X million jobs. Well, the create was something that you can measure, but the save is really something you can't necessarily measure, so therefore you can't really put your finger on whether it was successful or not. But as long as it looks like there was a bit of a benefit, well, maybe that did, you know, quantify into the saving area. But the same thing is happening with the, I guess we would call it the Sneaky Pete type of way of looking at what they talk about, how Germany says they're totally against a coordinated effort by the Eurozone to have backed bonds that are backed by the entire zone. They say they're not going to put any more money into Greece. Greece has no more time. Hollande is saying another thing. And there's a meeting at the end of this week that will determine probably nothing more than some very exciting rhetoric again. But Greece is looking for an extension on their terms once again. And again, remember, Germany has said absolutely not. They're not taking any more time because it will cost a lot more money to do so by funding them even longer. So whether you want to call it kicking the can down the road, stall tactics, you know, hopeful opportunities and creating some kind of a situation that makes everybody feel better until it's such a time that markets are stabilized enough to take a hit, I don't know. But you know what? It is probably in all of our best interest right now to take all of the news headlines with a grain of salt. We've been seeing that China has been showing some very weak signs on their exports, their imports, their overall housing numbers, even though we did see housing prices tick up a bit in a number of the areas in the last reading this over the weekend. That's good and bad. It's good because what you see is that there is some life in the housing market, but it's bad because China doesn't want to encourage speculation on properties because their banks are really starting to show a heap of bad loans. And that's going to be a problem for them because their banking sector needs to stay strong. At the same time, Wen, who is the prime minister or the head of all things coming out of China, has said again that now they're going to do everything. This is the new thing. We're going to do everything that we can to make sure that growth stays on path. So those words are being echoed on a regular basis by all sorts of leaders around the world. And you know what? In fact, here too, we see that Bernanke and his gang come out talking about, you know, whatever has to be done. If the economy does falter, we're going to do it. So those are things that are kind of in the backdrop of all this. But, you know, how many times can we put up with this till it's the, you know, the central bank that cried wolf that says, hey, we're going to do something like has been going on in Japan, where they're going to defend the yen and make sure that it doesn't escalate in value as it has done because of the safety trade. We've already seen that the euro is at close to an all-time low to the yen. That's creating a big problem for exports. The same thing is happening in China. China's exports were supposed to come in at 7% as compared to the last reading, and they came in at 1%. That's a big differential. That's something that we should notice. But, of course, the press immediately comes out with, well, that's going to give them more opportunity for easing, more opportunity for stimulus. I really am looking forward to a time when we do not have so much talk and so much market action that is devoted to stimulus because it creates a very unfriendly environment for the average investor. In fact, when you look at volumes, which most of the time volumes on a market are dictated by institutions, but really they've dropped off significantly. Ever since the Knight Capital incident, we've seen a big drop off in volume. Whether it was a coincidence that it was the summertime, whether it was some flow that's not being put through, whether it's a kind of tamping down on the algorithms, whatever the reason is. But at the same time, we're still seeing that individual investors are pulling money out of equity mutual funds and putting them in bonds or other places. And that's not a healthy environment. You need a balance between the retail investors and the institutional investors in order for successful outcomes for investing. And yes, even though the S&P 500 is, you know, approached a close to a high for this year, and the Dow is at a, I don't know, I think it's a 3-4 year high, highest since 2007. The fact remains that, you know, you have to wonder what's pushing all that. Is it the stocks that are pushing the markets, or is it the markets that are pushing the stocks? And the differential there is the institutions utilizing things like derivatives in the form of futures or in the form of ETFs to really move markets. We did a study just recently, and I haven't put it out yet. I will shortly. Looking at the difference between the S&P 500, which is a cap-weighted index, which means that the largest stocks in there, like Apple at $600 billion, which hit an all-time high last week, is a very big component in moving the market. So Apple up 1%, and, you know, let's say IBM up and ExxonMobil up. The biggest companies are playing a very significant part in moving markets recently. And you can say, well, that's okay, that's good. But at the same time, you have to wonder, wait a minute, why is everybody flocking to these? Is it really just these that are leading? Well, in the last, I would say, 3 months, there was an absolute move that showed that the differential between the standard S&P 500, which is the cap weighted, versus the equally weighted, which means that every stock in the S&P 500 has the same weighting, has been leaning towards large caps, because we could see that the market weighted index is outperforming dramatically. Much different than we saw at the beginning of the year when risk was on and there was all happiness that it was the beginning of the year and everything was just going to be solved and Europe was great and, or not great, but at least going to be solved and not going to disappear immediately. And then we saw a change in the complexion of that. It started in March and April and clearly in May, a change to the market weighted index. The cap-weighted index really was slowing down, and all of a sudden, equal-weighted index was slowing down as well. But at the same time, there was significant outperformance by the cap-weighted index, meaning that small caps were really not participating. That changed a bit recently. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, all of a sudden, we see that there was a new risk-on trade, and it started in the beginning of August, and probably due to the comments of Mario Monti and the gang over in the ECB and talking about how, you know, they're going to come up with some kind of a coordinated backing, or, you know, the ECB is going to buy bonds directly again, which is against the Constitution and against the current regulatory instrument they have in place. But if they do that, okay, everybody's happy. We saw the yields on many European bonds, I mean, just spiked down. The prices spiked down, but the yields go up. And that means that, obviously, people are willing to buy the bonds. At the same time, we saw that they're selling treasuries, particularly the 10-year went from a yield of 1.4 and change to like 1.8. That is a big move when it comes to the movement of that short-term treasury. So the question you have to ask is it moving because, one, the economy is better, two, people are feeling better and more comfortable, so they're rotating into stocks, or three, is it that they said, you know what, the yield is so low, well, let's take the chance of going into other bonds like Europe and emerging markets because there's a much better yield. I think it's a combination of all three, but at the same time, you have to realize that the opportunity that lies in Europe, if they're going to back it, is dramatic because their bonds had really, really been cut down pretty hard. So we'll see what's going to happen with that. But clearly you can see outperformance. And if you haven't looked at either mutual funds or ETFs that invest in European bonds, or just look at the European bonds themselves, we post them a lot, the risk factors and the bond yields on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Which, by the way, has a RSS feed. If you're familiar with that, you also have a way to get the email delivery of the daily updates. You could just, if you go to the site to the top right, you just put in your email address, and you'll get daily updates of all the things we write. So you could just have it right delivered to your mailbox, I think at about 7 a.m. Eastern time every morning. Things we write the day before. And, of course, on Twitter. You can grab that because the feed will hit right to the Twitter as soon as the information is out. It goes right to the Twitter feed. Now, what I want to talk to you about is the combination of the market move, which has been relatively in a tight range, if you have noticed. The S&P 500, which we're going to focus on, has been right around that 1,400 mark, right? A little bit above, a little bit below, but it kind of is pinned right about that 1,400 mark. Now, why is that? We had options expiration on Friday, last Friday. And what was really interesting was a piece out by JP Morgan that talked about the gamma trade or the gamma exposure, which is essentially the amount of risk exposure that was going to be betting on a move and the movement around a particular number, we'll say right now to make it easy. And again, I'm giving the layman's easy version, not the very sophisticated version of what all the different, whether it's the gamma or the delta, or, you know, I'm not going to give you all the statistical significance here, but I just want to tell you what the report said was that there was probably one of the highest levels of interest on on the gamma in terms of trying to keep the S&P as close to 1400, because there was obviously a tremendous amount of bets in the form of options on that 1,400 number. Round numbers always attract a lot of attention, a lot of interest. So what happened was that there may have been, for example, options that were expiring that were going to be, maybe there was a lot of options sold just under calls that were sold. Maybe there was some puts on the 1400 mark that were also sold. Who, you know, whatever, they were bought or sold. The bottom line is the totality of it. It was necessary for the primary dealers that were doing this to risk hedge out their risk, and by doing so, it pinned the S&P 500 very close to the 1400 level. This is what the report said, and more importantly, because this was the highest level that was seen in years, if not historically, of hedge protection on that level, that expired also. And their discussion now is that that really affected the VIX, causing the VIX to plummet in a position where it shouldn't be right now, considering the actual volatility, the realized volatility of the current markets. Now, that translates to a VIX that is severely undervalued, in theory, compared to what it should be, because the hedging factors that were put into play were very much affecting the overall volatility, and the VIX then therefore fell to, I don't know, 13.5 or so. Now, we have this information. What are we going to do with it? What does this mean? Well, if they're right at JP Morgan on this report, which is just a calculation, and I've seen these kind of numbers come out before where they show this, what that means is that volatility may or may not kick up essentially, you know, right away, especially if we have low volumes and a lot of disinterest because of the August time, the summer lulls. But what it does mean is there may be a great opportunity to either, one, utilize a position in the VIX to profit or hedge out a portfolio at a very low cost. And it also means, because there is such low volatility, that options on individual positions or maybe even on an ETF are very cheap. Now, not everyone will be cheap because there's more volatility on some things, but when we talk about an index, for example, it may be a very good time to look at an option play, for example, looking at calls or puts on the VIX. Now, we actually put on a VIX option earlier in the week last week, and what I found interesting about it was we put it on at about $1.10. We did the, I believe it was the 24 October, I believe that was the one. I don't have it right in front of me. I can't remember if it was September or October right now. But nonetheless, it was. We bought it about $1.10, and it closed at about $1.40, $1.50, and it was as high as $1.90 in the middle of the week. Well, if in fact the VIX does kick up a bit here, I think because of the very nature of how low it is, there could be a great opportunity. Now, you may say, Andrew, I don't really work with options. I don't really like options. I don't understand options. Okay. Maybe what you want to do is look at the VIX ETFs. Maybe. The ones that are the multipliers, you know, the two times VIX, there's a few of them out there, short and long, are not good plays because of contango and because of the basic structure of it. You may get a couple of days out of it that they work really well. But take a look at TVIX, something we've talked about before that we've used way back when, and we just stopped using it because we saw that there was just really no way to really utilize this for a, you know, long-term play, because it's down to about $2.50 right now. I mean, when it was $7, it was kind of low. And it just keeps on getting, you know, keeps eroding and eroding because of the very makeup of it. I hope they stop and pull these from the market, because I think they're very, very dangerous positions, and I think that investors really get the wrong idea with some of these that are not built correctly. Now, one of the things you can do is when you find these kind of scenarios, kind of a side note, when you find where there's a flawed product, where there's a flawed ETF, for example, some of the ETFs that are the leveraged ETFs that, you know, may move up with the VIX, may not move exactly with it, but they are flawed because of the very basic nature of using the instruments inside of there to try to mimic the VIX. Now, there's an interesting opportunity to short them. And I'll give you another example. You know UNG, the natural gas ETF? Essentially, that's kind of a flawed instrument as well. Now, it will move and has moved much more directly with natural gas of late. Natural gas came up. It came up with it. But over time, there has been and there looks like there will be a natural degradation of the share price due to a few things. First, fees. Okay. We know that there has to be fees inside of the ETF for the management to run the deal and all that. Okay, that's fine. But what we have is the continual rolling effect of the month-to-month futures inside of there, and the fact that when there's contango, it just naturally just, you know, it hurts this because the longer dated could be higher priced. And what happens there is when they roll it, you're going to get a worse price, and there's going to be a natural decline in share price. Now, that doesn't mean the share price is going to go down and down and down. I mean, it will go up with markets and, you know, be affected by natural gas pricing, et cetera. But, you know, when's there a time where we can say, okay, for a long term, maybe what we'll do is we'll short it. And we shorted it last week, actually. It was a couple days where it was up really nicely and it came in a little bit. And on, I believe, Wednesday of last week, it was up about 3.5%, and we shorted it. We shorted UNG, and we're profitable on it. And what's interesting about that is that could be, just a simple short, could actually be a long-term type of hold if you want to look at, again, just a simple degradation of the share price and the disintegration of the share price by a flawed product. Now, let's take a look at this. If we look at the differential between natural gas prices, the spot price, and the UNG price, and how the return has actually been different over the last, let's say, several months, natural gas hit a kind of a low back in April of this year. So if we look at from April, the end of April, beginning of May, through the 17th of August, we see that natural gas itself is up 35%. Whereas UNG is up 20%. That's a 15% differential. Now, why is that? You know, essentially it moves with it and highly correlated with it. But again, that differential is due to the fact that you have all these, you know, underlying problems. Now, the premium of the price of the fund to the NAV isn't as bad as it was with like a TVIX and some of the other VIX-oriented in ETFs, but this does show you that if you're going to see a potential for long-term degradation, again, long-term is the point here, and if natural gas kind of holds at these levels, and again, let's just say that natural gas stays steady, just doesn't move, just stays steady for the next few months, this essentially should go down because of not only the management fees, but because of the way the structure of this is composed. The underlying fundamentals of this. So, you know, take a look at that. There's not many places that you can actually invest in natural gas. There's a couple of different funds. I think it's Boyle, there's UNG. But, you know, look at this. And, I mean, the perfect play would be to actually go long natural gas and short UNG. That would be the perfect play if you can do something like that. You buy the futures and you short the natural gas ETF. So getting back and bringing it all the way back to the VIX, if you want to take a look at it, you know, take a look at some of the longer dated ones. I mean, you're going to probably see volatility into, I would say, September, October, November should be picking up due to the presidential election. A lot of things that are happening out there with the economy. You know, the votes that are going to take place in September in Europe. So there's going to probably be an enhanced volatility from a very low base. Now, does that mean that it's absolute? No. I mean, we've seen times when the VIX is down pretty low. But you know what? Where we are now compared to where we were in 2007. In 2007, if you remember, you know, nobody was really thinking anything terrible. We didn't even have a question about Europe. The real estate situation was starting to, you know, boil up a little bit there. And, you know, we started to see some drops in markets and things were happening. But really, we didn't have all these things in front of us that were much more well-known and well-telegraphed. Now we do. So the VIX being at 13 and change just seems like a little bit of a low point here. And if the analysis by JP Morgan was at all reasonable and all, you know, something that is that actually occurred, the VIX can be an interesting way to make a couple of bucks or hedge your portfolio out pretty cheap. Oil is heading up again. We've seen this problem with this little incident in the Straits of Hormuz where there was, a little ship crash, I don't even know how they managed to do this. But there was a crash, nothing major, but at least two ships, I think it was a U.S. Military Navy ship and to a tanker. And we're seeing more ships being sent over and deployed over there. We also have the commentary from Iran, basically that the infidels, which is Americans and Israelis, should be wiped off the face of the earth, and that they have enough weaponry and bombs that they can pretty much send them into Israel and obliterate tens of thousands of people, you know, at a time. And the question still remains, is Israel going to do something about this, offensive way or a defensive way? Obviously, nobody wants a war. Nobody wants any kind of fighting anymore that's going on. But there is a lot of provocation going on, and the words this weekend were not at all encouraging. But again, that is why we're looking at the VIX as an interesting way to maybe hedge out some of the risk. But oil is moving higher. Oil moving higher now already got the White House saying, hey, we're going to release the strategic reserves. We're going to put out all this oil, and we're at 95, for goodness sakes. We're not over 100, and I don't know why they're coming out with these threats that we know, by the way, don't really mean anything. They don't really bring down the price of oil. As a matter of fact, after the announcement, oil prices continue to go higher. You've noticed already that the price of fuel at the pump is going to be has been rising. And, of course, in a presidential election, they don't want that to happen. No, no, no. That is not a good thing. Because, you know, you see that every single day or every few days, depending on how you, fill up your car and what kind of mileage you get and where you drive to. But, you know, if you're like everybody else out there, at least once a week you're filling up, you're putting some gas in the car, and that is going to be a direct, you know, problem when it comes to consumer spending. Already we've seen that the retail numbers have been, you know, they came in better, but they're really not that good. Yeah, there's been pockets of things that are much better in the luxuries again, and, but many of the smaller ones, you know, look at Walmart, is projecting a much slower situation. A lot of the big box stores have been, you know, saying there's some concerning signs out there. Yes, things were better than expected, but if you look at the actual numbers, the raw numbers on consumer spending, it is down. And as we've seen, that savings is up. But at the same time, there has been some great opportunity. There's some great stocks out there. I mean, Apple hitting a high, Google doing very well, many of the big cap names doing just extraordinarily well. So I think that, you know, you have to be looking for individual positions now that make a lot of sense. Look at a breakout from, you know, from bases or at resistant points, and in fact, look for the good fundamentals. One of the things that's really interesting is the amount of dividend increases. Cisco came out with a 75% dividend increase, which says one of two things. One, they are worried about the fact that there's not a lot of place to deploy their money. They want to give some back to investors. And two, we know that there's a lot of funds that go after yield, so the managers are going to be buying into that. So the Cisco numbers, which were okay, they cited some weakness in a few areas in terms of their earnings and their revenue. Well, you know, again, they're not projecting anything great, but that dividend increase was a good sign to markets that at least they're comfortable with the future, that they can actually continue paying so. Well, let's get right now segue a little bit here to our discussion with Tom McClellan. I want to talk to you about sector rotation, some ETFs that I want to talk about, the earnings for the S&P, what's going on there. And I want to talk about this Greek meeting that's happening in the week. Just touch on that, just so you know about that. And then talk about some of the economics that are happening. But before we do that, let's just talk about GoToMeeting. We love GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is, we actually finished up our fourth in the series of Trigger Point Research webinars. All the replays are available on the Trigger Point Research website. Just go to triggerpointresearch.com/webinars, and they're all there, all the replays. But we use GoToMeeting, actually the GoToWebinar, where we can actually spend some time sharing our screen and having a great opportunity to have a conversation because there's questions and answers, there's polls. But GoToMeeting is one of those great products. It's easy to use, and it just makes life a lot easier when you can just sit at your computer at your home, your laptop, at Starbucks, wherever you want to be, and even your iPad or your portable mobile device, and you can have a conversation with documents, with sharing. You can actually view each other at the same time when you're having a conversation with their GoToMeeting HD faces, and it's very easy to use. You can do a conversation with family. You know, we talked about this. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to go to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. You have to use that promo code to get the 30 days of free use of GoToMeeting by Citrix. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's going to be something that works very well for you. And if you're like me, once you start using it, you're hooked because you can find so many uses for this great product. GoToMeeting.com, Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. You've heard him before here because he's just a great guest to have. Tom McClelland, the editor of the McClelland Market Report. I read his work every single day and on the weekends when he puts out special reports on a weekly basis. And there's a lot of things that I wanted to pick his brain about. So, Tom, I hope you're ready.
That's good to be with you, Andrew.
Thanks. Listen, so one of the things that you talk about quite often is the presidential cycle. You know, and there's a kind of a trend that happens oftentimes, and you've charted it out and looked at it. So can you explain to everybody kind of what is the general concept of the presidential cycle when it comes to stock markets?
Sure. People can think of it a lot like seasonality when we look at the normal seasonal pattern within a year, except instead of a one-year period, we're substituting a four-year period. And what I did years ago and what other people have done also, you take the stock market data and you chop it up into four-year blocks of time, and then you average it together. The math gets a little bit more involved in that, but that's the basic idea. And so you can create an average pattern of what the average performance is of the stock market over those four-year periods. Now, you can do this with any amount of time, but we find that there is a meaningful correlation between what the stock market does and what that four-year pattern looks like. Generally speaking, the first 2 years of any presidential term are wasted time. There are exceptions, of course, but on average, the first 2 years are flat. The third year is always an up year, unless Hitler's marching through Poland or we have a Dust Bowl in 1931. Otherwise, third year is always an up year. And election year is generally an up year, although there's much more variability to that. We're in the election year now, and there's also some difference between the Republican version and the Democrat version, especially in the election year. And what I mean by that, if you take all the Republican presidential terms and average them together versus all the Democrat terms and average them together. And so here we are in August, and on the Democratic pattern, there is a low that's due about August 21st. It's not a major low. It's more of a flat spot in the uptrend. So we're waiting for that to come in, and then September and October should be onward and upward according to the way that the pattern says. And most importantly, the stock market has been behaving very well in correlation to that pattern lately, so we can have more trust and faith that it should work and should give us an up period into the election.
Now, does it matter if it's a re-election? In other words, if it's a Democratic party sitting in the House at the time, and then all of a sudden it's the end of their term, is there any differential there?
It's a good question. And when you have a second-term president, like Clinton or like Reagan or like Eisenhower, then it is a little bit different in the election year because investors get a little bit more nervous. When you have a second-term president, you are guaranteed that you're going to get a new guy. And anytime that you have a new anything in the market, that makes people a little bit apprehensive. When you have a first-term president running for re-election, there's at least a possibility of stability, and so people generally tend to be more optimistic. Even when there's actually going to be a change, usually there's a good reason for the change, such as what we saw in 1980, after Carter's single-term presidency, and so you can have a generally more positive bias at the end of a first-term president. But you got to be careful. We haven't had that many presidents in the last 100 years, and so if you try to divide the data down into little piles that are too small and too refined, then you end up with a small sample size problem.
So now we are in this kind of directional movement that has been tracking the various, summarized, if you will, or brought together average presidential elections. And, I've been reading some of your work lately, and it seems that there's some kind of a little, I don't want to say Something's a little bit off in terms of how markets are behaving within the last couple of weeks. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I was expecting that the complacency that we're seeing in terms of the VIX being down at 13 or 14, I was expecting that to matter more than it has so far. And it's just instead has persisted. People are complacent and they don't feel compelled to give up that complacency. And when it's August and the head traders are all gone to the shore, and then it's left in the hands of the interns and other people, not much gets done. Not much motion gets put into stock prices. It's hard to get a move moving. When Congress comes back in September, when the head traders come back in September from their month at the shore, I think we'll start to see a little bit more action, a pickup in volatility. I think it'll be to the upside, but it should be a much more exciting time in September and October than what we're having here in the middle of August.
Yeah, because the VIX, I mean, is seemingly to be at a point where it's you know, the VIX doesn't necessarily have to move up or down dependent on markets moving up and down. It could be volatility. Volatility has been relatively tight. Volumes have been abysmal. I mean, volumes on the right. Would you agree? Volumes have been just awful.
Yeah, and it seems like a pre-holiday, and it's just I think more people in the financial industry are taking vacation this time, and I think it's also a factor that the European markets and the U.S. market are now much more closely linked, and everybody knows that Europeans all take 6 weeks off in August. It's tough to do inside of a four-week month, but they tend to go on vacation in August, and not much gets done over there. So if Europe is driving our markets, and if the European traders are all on vacation, then there's not going to be much driving that's going to be going on.
Now, one of the things that I read recently was the significant drop-off in volume overall right after the Knight Capital implosion, you know, that whole problem with their algorithms that went wild. And there was a... If you look at the chart, you could see almost like just a chop right at that point. So I wonder if it's possible that they had to kind of like change up what they were doing. Obviously, they didn't get the flow. It may have gone somewhere else, but there was kind of a lack of trading. Did you notice that at all?
You know, it's really hard to ascribe a change in behavior to one black box or another being unwired. It really is hard, and it's kind of outside my area of expertise, so I'll withhold comment about that.
I hear you. Okay, so one of the things that you look at is the euro currency, the commitment of traders. You pull it forward, you kind of look at the analysis of that, I think, over, is it 18 months? What's the time period that you look at compared
to? Let me correct you slightly. Yeah. We do look at the euro currency, but what I think you're talking about is getting a leading indication for the stock market from looking at euro-dollar
right.
data.
Yeah.
And the euro-dollar is different from the euro versus dollar currency. So it really is a shame that we have this conflict in our terminology. The term euro-dollar has been around for a long time, and it refers to dollar-denominated time deposits in European banks. It just so happens that the currency names are euro and dollar, and that gets everybody confused. But so what we're looking at is the commitment of traders data that's published by the CFTC every week, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. They sample all the people that have futures contracts. You know, if you or I go down to our local commodities broker and open up a small account, or if Goldman Sachs is trading, it all has to get counted up once a week, and they survey all the commodities brokers as of Tuesday, and then they report it on Friday to say who's holding what and how many of them. And so when that gets reported, they break it down into three different groups: the commercial traders, which are the big honking guys with the huge positions; the non-commercial, which are kind of in the middle, they're the hedge funds; and then the non-reportables, which is people that are so small in their positions that they're not even worth bothering to report individually. When we look at the data on euro-dollar futures, the interest rate product, not the currency, for what the commercial traders are doing, we find that gives us about a one-year leading indication for what the stock market is going to do. And it's just an amazing indicator. Just it tells us a year ahead of time what the money flows are going to be like into the stock market, and which direction the stock market's going to go. It's one of the best things we've found, and it's made us a lot of money, made our subscribers a lot of money by getting that idea ahead of time about what's supposed to happen. It doesn't work perfectly. And you wouldn't expect something that gives you a prediction a year ahead of time to work exactly perfectly, because news events will come along. But it does tell you what is going to be the pressure upward or downward on money flowing into the stock market.
It's kind of fascinating, I think, really, that you can look at something a year before that's not directly absolutely you know, involved in the market itself, not you know, like an option or something that maybe would be on a certain date, and pull that forward like you do. Because I've looked at that many times, and it's, you know, pretty interesting how the significant movement.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's yeah. But it's bizarre. I mean, right? It's weird that works so well.
And you know, and I would look at Woolly Caterpillars as a stock market indicator if I could figure out how to get a good leading indication from them. But I tend to, you know, look at things that are more likely to matter more.
Right.
Why exactly it is that the commercial traders' positions in euro dollar futures a year ago seem to matter for the stock market, I can't give you a mechanical breakdown of why it works that way. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you it's been working great for a number of years, and it's still working well, and it's working well enough that you can believe in it even if you can't understand it.
Now, one of the things that you talk about on the McClellan Oscillator quite often and regularly is the idea of simple and complex structures above and below the zero line. So, you know, looking at just make it easy, a zero line, and where the oscillator will go, and if it kind of just shoots up or shoots down straight line and kind of moves, that's a simple, right? Just a clean,
if
simple
line. If it just goes across and back, like a ping pong match, back and forth across the zero line, those are simple structures, yes.
Right.
If it can go one side of the zero line and then stay up or above zero or stay below zero and chop around without crossing it, then that's a complex structure. And the complex versus simple distinction is very important, because the complex side is the strong side. So if you can get the McClellan Oscillator up above zero, and people can go to our website to see a chart of it, it's mcoscillator.com, then they can see what we're talking about. If you can get the oscillator up above zero and chopping around up there, then that is a message that the bulls are in charge, they have control, they have the strong side of the ball, and you can expect that to continue for a while. When you have a condition like we're seeing right now for the last 3 or 4 weeks where it's just chopping back and forth across zero, doesn't get very far, the bulls will take the ball and they'll go three and out and punt, and the bears will get it and they'll go three and out and punt, and it's back and forth across zero. Neither side is really in charge. So you have a sideways market that's back and forth, and you can make money in a sideways market by selling high and buying low and repeating. It just helps to know that that's what you're in. At the time that we see that change and we start to see a complex structure above or below zero, that'll be a message that, okay, it's not this sideways back and forth ping pong match anymore. Somebody's taken charge and they're going to run with it and have a trending move. We haven't quite seen that yet.
So now, when you look at this and you look at the various trend and the, I guess, lack of conviction from either side, right? That's what it's saying. There's no conviction. And you look at the directionality of it at this point, I think what you're saying is, just to paraphrase and to restate this, is that there is no, even though markets have moved up or down or whatever, there is no specific trend that can be identifiable because it's been this choppy movement, right?
That's what the message is from the oscillator, yes.
Okay. And then what?
Now, I expect that the resolution of that will be to the upside, and that we'll have a nice trending move upward in September and October. But that's an expectation and a prediction. That's not an observation of what's actually happening.
Right. Now, what about the idea that when you looking at, because I know you look at some of these things, the new highs, new lows, how is that playing out these days?
New high and new low is one of the breadth indicators that people look at in the technical analysis business. It's a lot like looking at advances and declines each day or up and down volume. What we're talking about is a stock gets counted as making a new high or new low if it makes a new intraday high or low, the most extreme of the last 52 weeks. Years ago, they used to not do it on a rolling 52-week look back. It used to be in each calendar year because, you know, we're talking about guys with green eye shades and pencils and ledgers, and they're writing down all these things in pencil on the ledger, and so it was really tough to keep a rolling 52-week look back and without the aid of computers. And so they would just have one book for each year, except that, you know, on January 2nd, every stock is either making a new high or new low. So what they would do for the first few weeks of the new year, they would use last year's book, and then sometime around April, they'd switch to the new book. And so if you look back at the new high, new low data from the 60s and 70s, you're not looking at the same thing that we have starting in, I think it was 1979 when they switched to the new fashion of looking back 52 weeks to see new highs and new lows. When you see an uptrend starting, what you'll typically see is with each higher high in prices, you'll see a greater number of stocks making new 52-week highs. And then you expect to see that, and that's confirmation that the uptrend is gathering strength and more stocks are participating and they're all pushing ahead. When you see the S&P 500 or the Dow or your favorite index continuing to make higher highs in price, but you see a diminishing number of stocks making new highs, that's a sign of loss of participation by the stocks that were leading the way up earlier. Maybe you're getting a rotation to other stocks that are taking the baton and carrying it further. But that loss of participation by the leading stocks that helped initiate the uptrend, that's a troubling sign. And we've been seeing that this month with a diminishing number of stocks making new highs. In an uptrend, the number of new lows usually stays really low, and it's not very remarkable. It's not much worth paying attention to. But looking at new highs by themselves, you can see these important divergences. We've seen that, and it hasn't mattered yet. I was expecting that it would have mattered more than it has, but it is a troubling sign. And that tells me that once we get to around election time, this is going to be a long, tired uptrend, and we're likely to see some ugliness in the stock market after or about the election.
Yeah. So now, one other thing I want to talk about is the small versus large caps. You know, you look at the different measures of, okay, we got the large cap index, let's call it the S&P, small cap, Russell 2000, or whatever exact measure that you look at. And you can look at relationships of the two to see how things are playing, and maybe it would give you a little bit of an instinct, inference of the appetite for risk, right?
Yeah, so that's a really good way to look at it. I typically look at the Russell 1000 versus the Russell 2000. The Russell 1000 is the 1000 biggest capitalization stocks as tracked by the Russell Investments Company, and at last I heard it accounts for about 94% of all the market capitalization. And the Russell 2000 is stocks numbered 1001 through 3000. It's the guys that are not big enough to make it into the Russell 1000. And the Russell 2000 is now the benchmark index for small cap stocks, and they make up that other 6% of total market capitalization. The interesting thing, it's reminiscent of a quote that was attributed to Abraham Lincoln. Nobody's sure if he ever actually said it, but he said, he's believed to have said, God loves the common man. He must love them. He made so many of them. That same idea can be thought of when we're talking about small cap stocks. There are a lot more small cap stocks out there than big cap stocks. They don't amount to much in terms of market capitalization, but they are trading every day. You're witnessing a battle between the bulls and the bears in each of those stocks, and so that composite picture of what they're all doing can give you important information. But generally speaking, we find that when small cap growth stocks are leading in our relative strength model, that is the best time for the overall market. It's the best time for big cap stocks to go up when small cap stocks are leading, which is kind of contrary to, why would that be? And the reason is twofold. Generally speaking, small cap growth stocks are going to have a higher beta. And so in an uptrend, the stocks with the biggest beta are going to be working the best. Mm-hmm. And so it's an indication that, okay, you're in an uptrend. The other part of it has to do with liquidity, because small cap stocks, and especially small growth stocks, are terribly, terribly sensitive to good or bad liquidity situations. If liquidity starts to dry up, they're the first ones that get taken out behind the barn and shot. And so if you see small caps doing well, that's a sign that liquidity must be strong, because they couldn't do it well otherwise. If you start to see the uptrend continuing on and you see large cap stocks leading the way, that's a problematic sign, because it says that maybe there's not enough liquidity for everybody to do well, and it can be worrisome. We've seen that lately. Hasn't mattered. I think it's an early warning sign of the trouble that's going to come to the stock market after the election. I still think we've got another couple of months of up move to do. But, yeah, we're starting to see the signs that the uptrend that we've had since the 2009 bottom is starting to get tired and starting to wane a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that's really interesting is that there's something that a lot of people talk about. You know, it's not the news that matters. It's how things react to the news. And one of the things that's interesting is that almost any bit of news of late, you know, it's been reacted to on a big scale. I'm talking about economics. The economics have not looked good at all. Even the numbers that are better are still pretty bad. Economics don't matter as much anymore. Maybe it's the Bernanke put, or maybe it's the European situation, or whatever it may be. But I think that small caps have been, before this week, were really lagging dramatically, weren't they?
They have been lagging. They're just starting to come back again a little bit, especially with the recent up move in the Russell 2000. People like to look at economic indicators and make conclusions about the stock market, and that's just backwards. the stock market is going to give you the best leading indication of what the economy is going to do.
Right.
So if you're looking at an economic indicator and thinking, therefore, the stock market will do X, you have the relationship backwards. I like to tell people that when it comes to the overall stock market, there are really only two fundamentals that matter. And the first one is, how much money is there? And the second one is, how much does that money want to be invested?
Right.
If you change either of those two things, you move the stock market. You can earnings and dividend yield and book value, all that stuff matters for an individual stock. It doesn't really matter that well for the stock market. So focus on what's happening with the money. Focus on what's happening with sentiment, and you'll answer most of what's going to go on with the stock market.
I hear you. Well, I know that you also have a lot of information on your website, and we'll put that link, as we always do, on the show notes. It's MCOscillator.com, right?
That's right. It's like a McNugget, except it's a McOscillator.
McOscillator.
And short for McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969.
And still going strong, and we'll make sure that people can find you and get that information. I appreciate all the things that you do and the great statistics that you put out and the insight into the relationship of various different factors like we've talked about today. And keep up the great work.
Thanks, Andrew. And if people visit there, they can even sign up for a free weekly chart and focus email. It's just an article once a week about an interesting chart or indicator. No strings attached. It's just a way to get people more familiar with our work. You won't get any junk email from us. You won't get any solicitations. It's a true free lunch. No strings attached. They can sign up right on our website.
Great. Good stuff. And then actually, next time I'll want to talk to you about the whole solar spots and solar flares and the lunar effects on things, okay?
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom. Always enjoy spending time with Tom McClellan. I think he is great. I really do. Awesome stuff. Let's talk about some economics. I mentioned that before we got to him. This is what's happening next week. We have the minutes of the FOMC meeting coming out, which is important. We'll see probably a lot more a divided view on the outlook for stimulus, because we've seen some numbers that, you know, are better than were seen, even though manufacturing numbers are not as good. But, you know, we're not seeing the retail sales good either, but they're not falling off a cliff. We're not going to a recession at this point, it looks like. You're seeing that the jobs numbers, the NFP report was better than was expected, even though we saw a tick up on the unemployment rate. You know, we see that the homes are being sold a bit of a better clip. We're seeing next week also existing home sales, new home sales, and we're going to see what I think is going to be important is the durable goods report. You know, we mentioned that we saw that China's reports basically from import and export was horrible. And my question is going to be, is that going to bleed over to us? Are we going to see durable goods really slow down dramatically in terms of sales when it comes to big tickets? Now, that's different than, of course, you know, the import-export numbers that we've seen from China. But still, when we're talking about that, we're talking about big-ticket items, and oftentimes those go hand-in-hand and highly correlated. So I think these are really important. We're going to see a lot of housing data, and the NAHB has been pretty positive lately. They've been seeing some better things when it comes to building. We saw permits better. We saw some housing starts better. And if you haven't noticed, take a look at some of the home builder stocks. They've been really on fire, which is pretty cool. I mean, you wouldn't think they'd be at the levels they are, some of them at all-time highs or near all-time highs, but they are. So that's something to really take notice of, I think. And whether or not we look at all the economic numbers and try to relate them to the stock market or not, or just look at the earnings, you know, things are better in that area, and the potential for at least a bottoming, if not, you know, outright, you know, looking a little bit better, is much more in the cards. So I want you to kind of remember that and take a look at when the reports come out this week. We're looking for existing home sales to increase by about 3.3% on a month-over-month basis, which, you know, that's good. But remember, last month was a negative 5 compared to the previous month. So when you look at month-over-month, obviously if you have a big downdraft in one number, oftentimes it will level off. We'll see what the revision comes in at. But then we have new home sales as well looking to tick up a little bit, 4.5%, but again, the month before was a negative 8.4%, and the house price index to be up a little bit by about 0.5% after about a 0.8% increase the previous month. Just quickly, I want to talk about sector rotation. It's interesting. I put a chart up on this episode's show notes. And I want you to take a look at that, because this rotation that we've seen lately, we saw things like consumer staples and utilities, and we saw an incredible move recently in the telecoms and the healthcare, but that's all seemingly reversing a little bit. They're weakening dramatically as compared to the big move in energy stocks and the subsector of energy stocks. Materials are starting to move up, industrials, financials, and technology are moving up as well. Not as much, but getting out of their way. They were really rolling over pretty hard. But what's really interesting is that move from the, I guess we'll call it the defensive names, you know, the telecoms, the utilities, into more of the cyclical names. Now, remember something. A lot of mutual funds will do sector rotation where they find the worst sectors from a month, 2 months, 3 months, and they'll rotate money into it because what they're doing is just reallocating their portfolios on a regular basis. So that's what we're kind of seeing now to a degree, because we saw such a lagging amount of a lagging level of these sectors as compared to the others. So I want you to take a look at some of these. You know, when we rank and we take a look at what's happening with regard to you know, the different sectors, what we see is that the greatest improvement in the last month, from last month, from July through the through where we are today in August, has clearly been in the material sector. And even though month to date, we've seen the telecom sector do very well, they're not moving up as quickly on a relative basis. Consumer staples, though, went from the number three rank to a number eight out of the 10. Discretionary went from a 9 to a 3, number 1 being the best, of course. Technology went from a 4 to a 2. But really, the big jump has been in materials. And you can look at the ETF for materials is XLB. Industrials, XLI. And also, you know, again, look at the differential. The number 1 was energy last month, and it's number 4, so it's staying pretty good. So there's this kind of, you want to call it the risk-on trade, you want to call it whatever you want to call it. The fact of the matter is that there is a change in the complexity of markets, of what's actually happening, of leading versus lagging. Whether it's or not it's a simple sector rotation that happens during the month, towards the end of the month, sometimes in the beginning of the quarters, definitely, you know, it is going on and it is happening right now. Next week, pay attention, because there's going to be some discussion out of Europe, because Merkel and Hollande are meeting with Greece towards the end of the week, when Greece is going to beg for some additional time. I am very interested in seeing how this is going to play out, because here's the deal. If they give them more time after saying they're not going to get any more time and really, you know, sticking it to it and saying, hey, we're not going to do this, we're not going to give any more concessions, then you know what? At the end of the day, none of this matters. None of the discussion matters. They're not going to hold back. They're going to print until they just put themselves into a hole. And, you know, it may take years and years and years to get themselves to a point where they can't fund their actual debt anymore. In fact, we put up a post last week that shows the change in debt payments of all the European regions over the last couple of years. And boy, we're talking about a lot more debt payments that they have to make. Question is, when does it become a problem where they can't do it anymore? And all the countries end up being like, you know, like a Greece or an Italy or a Spain. When are we going to become that? Well, we will see. But right now, we are pretty much out of earnings season. About 98% of the stocks in the S&P 500 have delivered their earnings. Revenue was not so great. Outlook was really bad. EPS, they beat on very nicely. Many stocks. So that was good to see. Seems to be happening every earnings season. Right before we start the actual earnings season, analysts come in. They drop their expectations, and miraculously, 2 or 3 cent beats. So, you know, that's what we're looking at. That's the game we're playing. And as long as you know that, you can be successful. It's not the easiest thing. It's a very, very tough market right now. You know, you get these big swoops up, big swoops down. And, you know, if you have stops on, they're going to stop you out. It's not easy. I've talked to a lot of my colleagues that have been doing this for many years. They're having a tough time. Yeah, sure, you put them in the big names and you're happy, but you could have been quite miserable or stopped out in May. Bottom line is, keep to your plan, buy the, you know, best fundamentals, best outlooks, and the companies that have been able to weather the storm year in, year out, quarter in, quarter out. We have coming up Mark Farber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report. He's going to be here. We also have Doug Cass that we're looking to get on with and a couple other folks that we're planning in the next few weeks. So I hope you join us. Tell a friend. Please tell a friend. And, of course, check out Trigger Point Research, 14-day trial. Oh, man, you got to see, actually, on the front page, just go right there, some of the recent numbers that we put up in terms of performance of the individual trades. The last one that we just closed out was liquidity services for about a 17% gain in about 2 weeks or so. Anyway, I'll speak to you soon. Thanks for joining me. Anything that you want to talk about, just write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you soon. Have a successful week. Have a profitable week. Maybe even have a relaxing week. It's summertime. Enjoy what's left of it. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.